Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions' world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. The world of cinematic horror has its own class system. The major studios partnering with companies like Blumhouse and Ghost House have to appeal to the broadest possible audience and have made the franchise film the center of their universe. That's not to say it's a bad thing, just something that sands the edges off the transgressive stories that are the lifeblood of horror movies. It is the world of the independent film from which most of the original ideas and terror tales are birthed. The stakes and the overhead are not nearly as high for companies like A24 and XYZ as they are for the corporate conglomerates. And a film that grosses a couple million dollars at the box office can be considered a big success. I love being surprised by a movie, taken somewhere I think I've been before, only to discover that I haven't, and the filmmakers take sharp left-turn moves in opposition to expectations. A week or so ago, I saw just such a film and was delighted by it. Talk to Me centers around a group of teenagers, which is usually a red flag for me. But it is so human, so surprising, and so sure-handed in its handling of story and character that I was completely won over. It also contains genuinely frightening and chilling scenes that reached me, and I can be a tough audience. Even more surprising is that it's a debut feature film from the twin Filippo brothers, Danny and Michael, best known for their YouTube channel creation, Raka Raka, which is primarily comedic, but with heavy dives into horror. We're going to talk with these talented brothers about their journey from successful YouTubers to feature filmmakers who made a Sundance sensation that comes out in theaters in late July and see what makes them tick. Gentlemen, welcome to the slab, and thanks for joining us here.
Oh, that was great. That's amazing.
Thank you for having us. It's so cool. So cool.
Well, it was such a wonderful and surprising film. We get invited to a lot of screenings, but this was, it's really terrific. It's obviously made by people with a love for the genre. Where did that start? You were brought up in Australia. What part of Australia were you raised in?
It's South Australia. It's the part no one knows.
Adelaide.
Yeah.
And we've always just been obsessed since as long as I can remember with movies. And horror was the first one that was... I guess that we connected with, or like we were, there was a lady, our dad's friend, that would take us to the theaters to watch movies that we weren't allowed, supposed to be watching, you know, MA 15 plus, which is what in...
That's America's R.
America's R.
Like if you're under 15, you have to be over a guardian or a parent.
Right.
So she would take us to all the MA 15 plus movies. And I became really obsessed with horror because my mom was always very strict on what we could and couldn't watch. She's like, you cannot watch PG, medium level violence, the Australian rating system.
Right.
Like, she'd be like, be very specific. I mean, we weren't allowed to watch Chucky or any horror movies. And because it was forbidden, it made it that much more exciting to watch. And so
that was mum, because our mum and dad were split. So mum was like, you can't. And dad's like, do whatever you want. You know, and then there was that lady that took us to the theaters.
All those things. And then like we would always get around with our grandfather because he never understood. I would always get him to buy me R-rated films. And like he just wouldn't understand what he was doing. And I would pretend to be sick. I remember, pretending to be sick. And then getting him to go buy me The Exorcist book and Halloween 2, which was R-rated. So like, I remember,
I was the unit publicist on Halloween 2.
Were you really?
Wow. That's so amazing.
That was my first R-rated DVD.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
So cool.
Well, your enthusiasm for the genre is so clear. Were you alone in your love for this, or did you have mates that were also horror fans that you could share it with?
We had like 12 to 15 kids around the same age that lived just around the corner from us, you know. So every day after school, we'd go and make movies and fight each other with backyard wrestling. Those are the two things that we did, you know. And they weren't necessarily fans of horror, but they were just fans of everyone just hanging out. And, you know, they wanted to hang out with us, and that's what we were doing. So it was like, you know, we're making movies if you guys want to hang out, you know. So everyone would be part of our movies, and then the backyard wrestling thing. But we always would, like, we were obsessed with, like, with horror and that. It's so many different things. Like, we loved, like, the old Psycho movies, how the old ones were black and white, and then it turned to color and stuff. Yeah. So when we'd recreate our own, like, movies, we'd have the first ones in black and white.
Yeah.
And then that changed to color.
We were obsessed with, and then the first couple of things we made was called The Evil Flamingo. And we had six of these movies, which are a massive ripoff of Chucky, but we had my sister's flamingo doll. And then we would do, like, I'll show you a little bit of a clip later. Like, we were like eight, nine. We were creating like practical effects of like tomato sauce and all that sort of stuff. So we're just obsessed with, I think it was literally because our mum would not let us do it. And then we were allowed to do it. And then it was like, oh shit.
So you're getting away with something.
Yeah.
So that was your play. Other kids would play football and have their fun with their army men and things like that. And your play was putting together movies.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Even before the camera stuff, we would have toys, like say the army men, and we'd act out movies of them. And then make covers for them.
we used to draw covers. I got in so much trouble in primary school because like the teacher pulled my mum aside. She's like, these are like a little bit disturbing. She was showing the things that I was drawing, and I was drawing like, you know.
Yeah, like murder and things like that. I think Danny was one or two bad, you know, turns off of becoming a serial killer or something. Glad he found the outlet.
Anything that like scared me, I was interested in. Because I remember like... there was an article about Bigfoot in like the newspaper, and I cut it out and stuck it into this booklet. And then everything that was like scared me, like anything about killers or anything about anything horrifying, I would cut out and put into this scrapbook. And then my mum was so concerned. Like, she's like, what the fuck is this? I'm like, I don't know. I was just, because it scared me to put it there and try and not be scared by it or collect it. I don't know. It was weird.
Or like hide it in a book so you don't have to face it.
Yeah, I don't know. It was weird.
So you weren't pulling the legs off of insects and torturing little...
No animal bed.
That's great. So who were the people that you first realized were filmmakers? You watched movies, you love movies, but the idea of somebody actually making these movies and giving them a cinematic personality, who were the ones that inspired you where you first realized that's who these people were?
I know exactly what it was. It was Goosebumps, R.L. Stine. Because we used to collect, and we had all the Goosebumps books, and then we were like creating something in the backyard, and I'm like, I'm telling everyone what to do. I'm R.L. Stine, I'm the writer. And then our cousin's like, well, I'm the director. I'm like, what's that? And then like that was when I first found out what a director was, and that's when I started really breaking it down and like trying to understand. I was like, there was Children of the Corn, and I'm like, there's the same writer and director direct Children of the Corn 4. Like, I didn't understand it. I remember like talking to Jenny about it, the mum, the friend that took us to the movies, and then she's like, I don't know. And like, I just became really obsessed with like how it all worked, and
so you started paying attention to credits.
Yeah
And then like you know, behind the scenes, like, because you always, you know, the first time you see behind the scenes, you get overwhelmed as a kid because it's like, it takes all this for the what's on screen, you know, there's like, you know, 100 people there, like, what are they doing, you know, and that kind of figuring out what these people do and stuff. And I remember even like the first film set that I went on, like film set, it wasn't until, you know, 18, 19, that I was like, I kind of got a bit overwhelmed because I'm like, oh my God, there's a real grip truck. There's a real gaff truck. Like, this is a real thing. This isn't just, you know, you're not just behind the scenes on a movie. Like, this is real life. You can have a job in this.
Yeah,
you know?
Nothing like that was regular in Adelaide.
Yeah, no, no, so not it's at not all. Entertainment driven. It's not film driven.
It seems like so impossible.
Yeah.
Because like, I remember telling like a teacher, I'm like, I want to be a filmmaker. And he's like, we've all got our dreams.
Or even like our dad. Our parents were really supportive. Like dad turned, like when we were in grade 9, like turned our whole garage into a green screen because we were trying to become, you know, we'd always try, how do we make things look more cinematic? And we're always just following what we saw on, you know, behind the scenes and stuff or movies that inspired us. But he said to us as well, pursue it, but have a backup. Like have a normal job in something so you don't have to try and just rely on that. But we could never do that. I could never hold a normal job.
I've never had a normal job.
You've never been able to do it. Like I've had two normal jobs that lasted under a week.
My job, yeah, I used to check into medical trials and they would test out drugs that weren't on the market yet. So like that was my job. And I was like,
you were the guinea pig.
Yeah, literally. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, they're like young males between 18 and 21 would like check in. They'd give us drugs and then they just survey us there for a month to see what the side effects were.
And Danny would write and turn yellow. And
yeah, I turned yellow once. Yeah, yeah.
That's what Robert Rodriguez did. He would do that and he would give blood. And that's how he made money to make his first movie.
Yeah, that was Danny. Yes, that was what he did. I was doing like volunteer work on films, anything I could just for free. And I'd done like 5 movies. And then one of the producers said, you can't keep doing everything for free. And I was like, I just want to be here. I just want to get experience because I was loving it so much. And then she said, next film will be, will be paid. And that was The Babadook.
Well, so I was going to ask about that. What did you do on The Babadook? And how did you manage to get those jobs on the set outside of Adelaide? I'm assuming it was probably Melbourne.
No, it was in Adelaide.
It was in Adelaide.
Yeah. So I got the job. I don't think I was qualified at all for that job. But I had done so much free work that the line producer, Julie Byrne, said, next film I do, I promise I'll hire you as a paid runner, production runner.
So you were a PA.
I was production runner. Like I picked up Essie Davis. Like I picked up the actors, dropped them off. Yeah. It was all the driving stuff, you know. And there was this big important producer coming down from interstate. And they said, this producer's important. You have to be there at 5 a.m. I'm like, no worries. And I'm like, okay, switched on. And I went home. And in the morning, I realized I forgot the address at the...
Oh, no.
The Screen Corporation. So I drove. I was ringing everyone. It was too early. No one was awake. I drove to the Film Corporation. No one's there. I'm trying to open the door. No one's there.
Oh, no.
And I look up where our office was, and there was like a door that was like slowly just a little bit open. I'm like, oh. So I started scaling up the building.
Like Spider-Man. And I tried to pull
the door. The door was locked, but it was like open a little bit, and I pulled it and broke the lock, and the alarm for the whole building went off. And I ran, grabbed the address, dived off the side of the balcony, got in the car and drove. And I was just there on time to pick up the producer. And I was covered in sweat. How's it going? And then she got in the car.
So did you guys share these experiences?
Was
Michael the more exploratory one here?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, because he was the runner. I was on the lighting team. I was assisting of lighting on Babadook.
Then he was... work experience.
Motherfuckers. I did all this work.
They're work like, experience, we'll give you, guys. Let's just get that right.
I was on for work experience and they're like, do you want a job on here? And you keep coming back. Like, we can't pay you, but we'll give you a credit in the movie. And I was like, yeah, hell yeah. So I came back and I was just on set, lighting assisting. And then the film came out and they credited me as work experience. And I was like, oh, what? That's my first film credit is a work experience. It was so embarrassing.
But on a great film, you must awesome have film had the best education on that film. It's such a classic.
Yeah, it's amazing. Jennifer Kent's amazing.
It was, yeah, the first director that we saw that really, really cared and was passionate. And like the other film sets we'd been on felt like they were just making junk and like no one really cared and no one really had a vision. And then this was like the first film where like, oh, fuck.
She shares that every shot, every frame. Every time I'd drive her home, I'd see how much, like, oh, her whole wall was covered with, you know, what's the next day and stuff. And even with like, and it was a tough shoot, but she never like swayed from her vision. And I really respect that about her. Like, she was getting what she was going to get what she wanted no matter what. And I love that about her.
Well, it's wonderful. And it shows in the movie, but it depresses me that that's the first filmmaker you ever saw who did care that much, that the people you'd worked with before did not. That surprises and depresses me.
Yeah. Well, like, say from directing, like from directing stuff, right? The stuff that I'd worked on before that was more like a job. It felt like a job. Everyone's just doing their job, you know? Whereas that was like, this isn't just a job. This is art. Yeah, this is art.
Yeah, it's art.
This
yeah.
is cinema. This is making something that will be remembered. Like that's the vibe I got from her that people maybe didn't connect with on set that I just loved. I was like, every weekend or whatever, I just kept telling them, anything you need, like if you're going out, just let me drive you around, make things easier, whatever. I'm 100% here. I want to be involved because I loved it.
Well, how great to have an on-set inspiration that you could carry with you for the rest of your career.
Yeah. It's amazing. And like, also, we did so much jobs with all different departments. Like I worked with grip, I worked with stunts, I worked with sound. So I kind of understand how... I understand how things work on set, and I have like an empathy for those people as well because I've worked with them, you know, and like the grips, man, they got such a tough job, 16, 17 hour days lugging equipment in the Australian desert, you know, like it was good to hire those same people for our films because a lot of them we brought back, like that I worked with that I liked, that I thought were cool people for our film, you know, they crewed on ours as well.
Well, you're not only learning the technical aspects of constructing a film, but you guys were actors too. So tell me about how that happened and where that went, and then we'll get to Raka Raka and how that led to Talk to Me.
Yeah, well, we got approached to talk to like a class of students for, they were doing some research for the film, a series called Deadlock. And then, so we just came in and like told our story because we were like YouTubers at the time and we showed a video. And then the girl that was writing it and like creating it saw us and then wrote us into the show. She's like, oh, it's sort of based on them. And then the producer's like, why don't you just get them? And then so they approached us like, do you want to act in this? And I was like, act? Seriously, acting? And
I was like, they said yes, not thinking it was actually going to get picked up. Yeah, sure. They're like, it'll help us. We're like, sure. And then they said, you know.
We're shooting them. Really? I was like, oh, shit. Oh, but it was also like really pivotal and important to me, like to know what it's like to be directed. Like I was like curious to feel like, oh, I want to see what it's like to be an actor. And then so, like, I can have that experience when I'm directing actors myself. So I remember that being really important to me.
But like, acting, like, we just did it from kids because it was just, like, we were making videos, so we kind of did everything, you know? And acting was, like, our friends and that. We would do it with our friends. We never wanted to be or want to be actors, but it's just something that, you know, it was a kind of a necessity of when you're filmmaking with your friends and that. So we always were just acting and performing for camera.
Well, has comedy and horror always been your first love in movies?
We're actually more of a fan of like drama films.
Really? Like, yeah. What are some of your favorites?
My favorite TV show ever is In Treatment. Just the therapist and the patient and like,
originally an Israeli show.
The Israeli show, yeah. I love the original as well. Yeah, I love that storytelling. I love those characters. Like they felt so real, and like and those performances were so incredible. So I was really obsessed with that show, and
Bong Joon Ho,
Memories of Murder.
Memories of Murder is my favorite film because that's the perfect blend between genres. You know, that's funny, dark. And it's a drama and it's thriller. It's like everything merged in one and they bounce between those genres so seamlessly.
And even like the composition of all the actors in the frame, like
it. So it goes from like a wide shot with like four or five actors and then it will change frames to a single shot at the end of it. It kind of reminds me of The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. It starts off with a close-up. I don't remember who the actor was, but it's a close-up of his face. And it's like, okay, it's close up his face. And then it pulls out. And as it's pulling out, it's revealing something new. He's on a noose. He goes further out. There's other people with him. He's not alone. It keeps pulling out. They're sitting on horses, you know?
Yeah.
And there's like people there and they're about to be executed. It's like that kind of revealing things with camera.
That's, without cuts.
Yeah.
But doing it cinematically with... And that's something you have to know beforehand because so many people rely on putting pieces of film together to make it work because they're afraid of committing to something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's like with our film, we really sat with our DOP and figured out the visual language before. Like we loved shot listing every day and coming up with a style for the film. That was like something that was important to us. And like the opening, every corner revealing something new, you know, like, yeah, using the camera to kind of, instead of just going, yeah, oh, let's just cover it every way and then work it out in the edit. It's like, go in with a vision and you can have some backups, but you know what you want to get, you know? And that was exciting.
But just so you, like, full transparency, we're like terrible at, like, we're not that literate in film language. So like, if we talk, we might sound a little dumb, but
hardly. No, that the film speaks for itself. It's very elegantly made. It's beautifully made and confidently made and surprising to be a first feature. But let's talk about YouTube as a platform to get yourself established. And you became the Raka Raka Brothers. Tell me how that started and where that began and how it bloomed.
Yeah, yeah. So like between like the ages of 13 and 18, we had like a show that we're doing with our friends. And we did 10 seasons of this show. We're doing 6 movies. There was 80 episodes. And you could sort of see us growing as filmmakers as those seasons were progressing.
Not on YouTube.
They weren't on YouTube. They were just making it for our friend's older sister. We used to like air it for her. And like we would premiere these episodes. And then as we were like approaching the end of high school, our friends were outgrowing it and we're like doing the 6th and final film. And I'm like, it's Timofey 6, everyone. And they're like, yeah, I've got a date with my girlfriend. Like, I'm not fucking going there to spend my weekend there.
Not their priority.
Yeah, not their priority at all. And so like,
we're all trying to juggle like we were organizing massive shoots for the weekend, right? Yeah. And then the lead guy would be like, oh no, I'm going to the cinema with my girlfriend.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So like, for 2 weeks we tried to organize it. He's like, no, sorry, next weekend, you know.
It just got to the point where people were outgrowing it and they're like, because they're not, so a lot of things were just doing it for fun and all that. So
yeah, they weren't looking for a career in the entertainment.
In the film, yeah, yeah, exactly. And like we were, and so it like, that project stopped and I had no way to be creative. I was like, oh shit. So then I just started making small videos online, like fake fails is what I first like made. I like pretended, I was like, I got dared to stick a knife in a toaster in a video. And then I end up sticking a knife in the toaster and then it blows up. And it was like practical effects and like VFX all blended together, but presented as real. And like these clips would go really viral, these fake fails. So it'd end up on like Jimmy Kimmel and Conan O'Brien.
Nice.
And like no one knew where they came from. They're like, who made these clips? So our friend who had a YouTube channel called The Royal Stampede convinced us to make a YouTube channel to put everything onto. So that's when we made Raka Raka and we just started making stuff for there. And within the first year, we had 1 million subscribers.
Wow.
And it blew up so quickly. Well, it was crazy.
Well, there was one video that we had. It was on like 3,000 views. We went to bed, woke up, and it was on 500,000. We're like, whoa. And at the end of the day, it was on 1.5 million.
And you can make a living off of that.
Yeah. Well, to begin with, we refused to. So we didn't put ads on the videos because... There was something in us that's like, we're not doing this for money, so we're not going to make money on it. So we didn't put ads on it.
It was weird, yeah.
Yeah, and then we thought our fans would respect that, but our fans were like, what the fuck are you doing?
Monetize the damn videos.
You know, so...
This could be pay your bills.
Exactly, yeah. When we got to 1 million subscribers is when we monetized, finally.
But we constantly, like, every dollar we made on our videos, like, even with brand deals and all that sort of stuff, we'd put it back into the content we were making. So we're just constantly broke
never business-minded with terrible like business being people. Smart with money. It's like, how can we make this better? And every dollar can be used to make it better. So let's do that, you know?
Now, siblings often are either very much apart or very close, being twins especially. How do you think that affected the way that you grew up together?
You know, I think we're both close and apart. We're close business-wise, but apart personally. Like, I don't talk
so you
to
don't
about,
hang out every day together.
Well, if it's we kind of do because it's work orientated and our lives is just 24/7 film.
But if I had a chance, if it was like, oh, there's a movie night I can go with Michael, or I can pretend it's not happening and he won't know about it and I'll go, I'd rather pretend it's not happening and go.
Yeah, like we won't talk to each other about our personal issues, you know. Yeah, it's like right. It's just the film, it's just filmmaking.
Yeah. And yeah, I have to baby him. He's the unreliable twin, so, you know.
Oh, I see. Yes. Okay.
I see
getting
someone
insight.
Nodding in the background there.
Yeah. Like, I'm getting publicity person back there. Like, they're like, even my managers or agents and stuff, everyone's like, where's Michael? I'm like, do I really have to baby this loser?
No, you know, we're focusing on so much stuff. It's like hard to keep a handle on everything.
The funniest story is he was a week late to pre-production of Talk to Me.
That's
how unreliable
this guy. No. I got stuck in... I got COVID in America.
Oh, okay.
Whatever your excuse was, buddy.
Oh, yeah. Excuse.
I think that one works.
Yeah. Like, as soon as I went to get on the plane, because you do a test back right. there to get on the plane, it was...
you're done. I'm like, oh no. And I was sitting in the hotel and I just join in on the Zooms. And then when they go, all right, we're going to go. I'm like, do you want to Zoom it? When, you know, keep me on the video?
Oh yeah, like we're checking out locations.
And he's like, can you Zoom it with me? I'm like, no. And I hung up.
Yeah.
Can you send video pictures of the location?
So as the Raka Raka brothers, whose responsibility was what? Is one of you more technically oriented and the other more performance oriented? How does that work with a relationship? You know, we talk about filmmaking as being such a group effort, but directing, writing and directing and starring in as the Raka brothers, that's complicated.
Yeah, yeah. So like, I would always like have the rough idea of what we're doing. Like sometimes I'd script it. Sometimes we just go into a location and I have a rough idea in my head. And I was always behind the camera. So I shoot all the Raka Raka stuff. And Mark was always in front of the camera. So I'm behind it. He's in front of it. And then usually on the Raka stuff, I would do a rough cut. He'd do a fine cut. He'd do sound effects and music. And I'll do color grade and VFX. And that's how we used to break it up. And then as we progressed and got bigger and bigger, we were able to get people to come in and help us out with our VFX and our makeup. And like, help us shoot it and stuff. But like, that was the core. And even with like the film, once we got to talk to me, he was leading the sound effect and music. He was like conversing with those departments more than I was. And I was like, you know, doing the other side of it. So it was like, yeah, we broke up in those sort of roles.
Yeah. Like, and like, there was a lot of, you know, there's a lot of stunt orientated stuff with the Raka Raka. So that was like, that was cool to, well, Danny had the easier job on that one because he'd just say action and I'm the one getting hit by cars. And then Danny goes, it doesn't look that, you can do it a bit faster, you know? Like, so, but it was cool, like, through that to meet stunt performers and then, like, find a crew that was, like, that wanted to create, do new and innovative stuff to, you know, ways of shooting stunts. So we did rigs and stuff that had never been done before. You know, we'd love creating that stuff with our stunt team. And we're looking forward to doing an action film because I think we can bring a side to it or a point of view with it that hasn't been seen yet, I feel.
So Michael's writing an action film right now. I'm still writing horror, so. Yeah. And so, yeah, we had the first draft to talk to me, like, I always send it to Michael. Michael will give notes. And he's like, goodly brutal. Like, I finished.
We can be honestly brutal with each other.
You were very honest. And so, like, we finished a horror film called Bring Her Back. And I'm like, oh, I love this. And I sent it to Michael. He's like, boring. He's like, it's good, but it's boring. Like, get the stuff quicker. And so, like, it was, like, good feedback for the next draft. And it's like, at first, I'm like, what does Michael do? And then, like, more of a sitter, I'm like, oh, yeah, actually, yeah, I can see how.
Well, it's kind of like, what are you trying to do? Like, we love the, like, say that script was like, it was like a family drama, which is great if you want to make a family drama, but if you want to make a horror film, you know, it's a bit slow for a horror film.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So it was good for the next draft to like, yeah, remember it's a horror film and not get lost in the drama of it. And,
well,
and
you know what? We both do that. We both love the, like when we're doing a writing genre, we tend to lean more towards the drama for some reason. It's like balancing them. Like we want to talk to me to work on as two films, a drama film and a horror film.
And even like the 20 minutes that we ended up cutting out from the film, like for the final cut was all drama scenes. It was not any horror. It was all like, it's like, all right, the actors are conveying this on their face. We have awesome performers. And like, what's integral to the plot and what's not going to sit there and linger on stuff that doesn't need to be lingered on, you know?
So the transition from YouTube channel to a feature film, an A24 feature film. How did that come about? Did you pitch it? Did you just start making it on your own, writing it on your own? How did you go about and make that transition to feature filmmakers?
Yeah, it was like the YouTube channel kept getting demonetized, the videos kept getting removed and stuff because we made really graphic and violent content. And so like they were like, oh, this isn't really right for the platform anymore.
Initially it was like they were pushing it because we were kind of one of the only channels doing like filmmaker stuff like that had. Like,
oh, that's not entirely true. There was still like.
Of the few that was doing like filmmaker stuff. A lot of the other content wasn't that. It was kind of gaming and reacting and things like that. We were doing like filmmaking stuff. And that was a few channels. It was like a kind of select, it was a niche. So YouTube initially promoted us like hard. Like, look, they're not just, this is YouTube's everything. They're doing filmmaker stuff, you know? But then, you know, to be fair, we have a tendency to push the envelope a little bit as well with the violence and things like that. And YouTube changed its policies to be more family friendly.
Yeah, so know? Yeah, to give an idea, is like you can watch one of our videos called Mortal Kombat Fatalities in Real Life. And so like we created some Mortal Kombat fatalities and it's so graphic. And it's a surprise. YouTube removed it. We ended up convincing them to put it back on. But like that content, they weren't really pushing anymore. They're like, okay. And so I sort of lost like my way of being creative on the platform. Like it was too many red tapes. And I was like, I don't really know how to make stuff anymore, like within these guidelines. So that's when I started writing again, which we were doing before the Rakaraka stuff. And I sort of lost that because we got so carried away with doing all the YouTube stuff and like exploring ourselves as filmmakers that I stopped writing. And then so... like Talk To Me was when I first sat down and like got back into it for the first time. And I feel bad. There was another producer, Julie Byrne, who got Markworth, his first job on Bubble Duke. We did have a film that we were writing called Concrete Kings. But then because we were doing the YouTube stuff so much, we never really put the time and the care into that. So that project sort of stopped.
You were distracted. Yeah.
We were very distracted. And it was a very difficult, it was our first attempt of doing like a Bong Joon-ho Memories of Murder with the genre, you know, the blending genre. And it didn't really work. Like it was like we were trying to do, trying to merge the drama with action, with comedy in that. And it wasn't really, it's tough to do, you know, and it wasn't really working. So it was, and it was like writers, new writers kept getting attached and like, it just wasn't, you know, mixing right. It just wasn't playing right.
We learned so much from that because I was trying to tell a writer that we ended up getting that I really liked. And I was like, oh, make sure to include this in the scene and this. And I'm like, oh, let me show you. And I wrote like an outline. I'm like, oh, like sort of like this. And then she said to me and the producer, she's like, I'm not saying this because I don't want the job. I'm saying this because I'm being honest. I think you should write this movie. She's like, you've done all this. Like, this is your head. This is your creation. She's like, you can write. I think you should sit down and properly learn how to write. And so that was like, it sort of gave me the confidence to like, do a draft of Concrete Kings and then like after that continue writing on and off. I just like got a bit of confidence from that. I just kept sharpening that skill.
And that's why having a great co-writer, Bill Hinsman, who co-wrote the film with Danny, he's lives and breathes script, you know, and film. And that's all he does and it's all he's ever done. And like we discovered him in film school, the media course that we did. He was the only one that was serious about it like we were. Everyone else was kind of like there for kind of like a laugh and to hang out and stuff. He was about filmmaking and we were about filmmaking, so we were naturally drawn to each other.
And it was like he was so much older than us because like he was like in his mid-30s and we were 18, but like we connected. I'm like, because we're the only, like, yeah, there were other people there that were really into it, but he was really into it, and so I really connected with him. I brought him over. I'm like, Dad, this is my friend. He's like, hey. Dad's like, oh, hey. But like, we just like would collaborate and write all the time. So like before the YouTube stuff, we did a short film called Deluge as well, which is about a father and son in a suicide cult. As the YouTube stuff took off, got distracted and then eventually got back into it.
And so Talk To Me in particular, how did that come about?
So there was a film that we were writing, another horror film that had all these same characters in it. I had the idea of these characters and stuff. And then Daley Pearson, who's a producer on a cartoon called Bluey.
He's a creator.
Oh, yeah.
He sent me a short film, which was like kids, a short film script of like kids having fun with possession. And then I like read it. He's like, do you want to do a pass and direct this? And I was like, yes. And so I like sat down, like I got it and I started writing. I rewrote, did my pass. And then I literally just couldn't stop writing. And like the characters and everything just like was flowing out of me. And like after like a couple of days, a few days, I had like the first draft, which was like 80 pages of like rough notes and characters and scenes. And
so you find your hands writing rather than your head.
Yeah. You just go with the flow. And then like I send that to Bill Hinsman, our collaborator. And I'm like, well, what do you think? And then he would give notes and stuff. Then he would do a pass and he'd send it back to me. And then we'd get the ball rolling like that. And then eventually we had a script that were like, oh, like let's take this out. And so we... send it to Causeway.
Did you have agents then?
So we had our managers, not agents.
We only got managers because Danny sent an email to some film company.
I think I sent an email to the head of Fox or something. And I was like, hey, I've got this script. Do you want to make this? And they're like, this is not really how you approach things. Like this.
He's like, managers?
He's like, I think we should get you some managers so you can sort of learn how that side of the industry works. And so that's when we got our managers. They sort of sent it out and then we got our Causeway attached because we'd known Causeway and Sam Jennings and that they really liked the script. They signed on to it. We took it. They did another couple of passes. We took it out to Hollywood and our managers were like, get us meetings here, here and here. And pretty much everyone said no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's like, no, no, no. They're like, oh my God, this company. Oh, this company. They're like, no. I'm like, oh shit, this company. They're like, no. And everything gets kept and shut down. And then there was one studio that after a few months said yes. And we started getting creative notes that were just sort of steering it into a direction that we weren't that. Like, yeah. I'm like, oh, this feels a bit typical or a bit stereotypical. And I was like, I don't really, like, I wouldn't want to direct this or write this. Like, I'm bored with the idea of this avenue that they were sort of proposing. And so those notes sort of made us like discuss it with our producer Sam and just say, let's just make it independently in Australia. And that was, it would be like, because way smaller budget and stuff, but yeah.
That was the thing, is like, you get, you know, told it's gonna be a big budget and all this, but creative control and things like that, you know, you hear the nightmare stories of directors that, you know, sign onto a thing that's got budget or whatever, but then it just gets taken away from them and recut, and then turns out shit. You know, like, we were so afraid of that. And it was tough. It was actually a really tough decision, because it's like, you can make this with a Hollywood studio, like, that's our dream. But the creative vision came first, and it's like, we're not confident we're going to get that with this.
Yeah, you've got gatekeepers.
Yeah.
People who are going to try and make your film more like other successful films.
Rather than
be its own thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, it'd be more geared towards, like, say, the success of the film based on what's worked in the past, as opposed to what's best for this project in particular, what's best for the film.
And like, to be like completely open, honest, like, the notes they were giving weren't bad at all. They were really good notes, and I understood where they were coming from, but it wasn't connecting with me, and I was a bit scared of it. And I think there was some stuff going on with Causeway and them anyway. And then, so I don't know, we just ended up saying, let's just make it independently in Australia.
Well, even like, yeah, all that, we kind of rolled the dice for the every, you know, step of the way, even using Australian accents and stuff like that, you know, because you're told Australian movies don't make money. Why are you going to do it?
Yeah, they're like, they don't sell overseas. They're like, they're very like to that country only, is what we got told. So that was scary as well. But
it was kind of like our YouTube channel. We have Australian accents in that. Well, actually, sometimes we imitate. We do our own American accents, but it's mainly
for better or for worse.
Yeah, definitely for worse.
It's Australian. Yeah, we're Australians making it in Australia, but we're not making stuff just for Australia. We want to make stuff that's international. And we kind of showed that, I guess, with the YouTube channel a little bit, that our biggest audience wasn't Australians. Our biggest audience was America and every other country. Australia was way down the list on the top countries watching our YouTube channel.
So
why wouldn't that be that way? Same way with the film. So we kind of just, went for it and made the movie we wanted to make. And whatever happens, happens, you know. We're happy with it.
Well, there's a long history of Australian horror that has been internationally successful. I mean, Babadook and Wolf Creek and Picnic at Hanging Rock and all kinds of things that really kicked off in the 70s. Thirst was another one that's... So how do you feel about being a part of that Australian horror history?
Oh, yeah, it's awesome. It's such a cool honor. And, like, I want to film all my films. I want to bring it and shoot everything in Australia. Like, we just love being there. We love the people there.
It's just the crew that we put together, you know. It's like, I felt like the crew was 85% the people that was like, wanted to be there, and it's fun. And like, a good crew is integral, you know. If you're going to be on set, it's already a difficult process.
He's talking about Australian cinema, not crews.
No, tributaries are all welcome. Exactly.
but the crew that we made of just the people in Australia, it was like just the crew that we've worked with now. That's like, we're comfortable. They know how we work, and we work not conventionally, you know, so
we're a bit much, maybe.
Maybe a little bit much, you know, that. But they were, cool with that, which is...
But like, it was like our lawyer, because once we had to reinvest our fees to make budget. And our lawyer was just saying, he's like, 8% of Australian films make their budget back.
Wow.
So 92% of Australian films aren't financially successful or like, make their budget back or even go into profit. So those figures were like, whoa, I didn't realize that. I didn't know that. But that's how much it doesn't translate usually.
Well, I shot a pilot in 2000 in Australia called Lost in Oz that was a show that never went forward. But I love the work ethic. I love the commitment and the joy with which that crew approaches it. What do you think are the hallmarks of Australian cinema, whether it's horror or just in general?
Oh, shit. Mad Max.
These are the hallmarks. Like, yeah.
What do you think of the qualities that are unique to Australian cinema?
Man, this question's above our heads. We're so dumb.
That's obviously the humor, not the case.
Maybe.
The humor? I think that there's a... this question is like, I'm bad at this talk.
Well, there's a very strong sense of independence with the Australian people, not just with the Australian cinema, and it seems to be well represented by that.
Right, right. Yeah, see, we're not too
familiar with
it. It
feels like it's laid back in a way.
Yes.
Like, people don't take themselves too seriously.
Yeah.
You know, it's like kind of, you everyone there you can have a good time with, it feels like, you know, especially when we were making a film.
You're going back to Crew, you talk about cinema, right?
Well, no, geez, all right.
But I think they're the same thing. I think it's the social representation as well as the artistic representation that there's a sense of renegade about Australia, both in the movies and the people. I mean, it was a prison island.
Yeah,
that's what we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, like I said earlier, we are dumb.
Just the opposite. Well, tell me where the game, Talk to Me centers around a game called Talk to Me.
Yeah.
Where did that game come from? Was it something that you just made up?
Yeah. So like that game aspect for it was in that initial short film. The hand wasn't in it. It just said haunted object.
So the hand is a ceramic hand that supposedly surrounds a genuine hand of a psychic.
Yeah. So
as far as the kids know.
As far as the kids know, it's sort of like everyone has their theories about it. And everyone, the rules that they've made are like, the kids have made these rules, but are these the rules? Or like, we just wanted the kids to be in over their heads and not understand what it was that they're messing with and like not know the history of it. Which is one of the notes that we got, was like really dive into the past of it and figure out how to beat it and the origins of it. And whereas I wanted the kids to not know what they were fucking with.
And it doesn't even matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah.
The story is driven by the action, not by the history of the hand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
And the
characters' reactions to it.
The second draft was when the actual hand came in. Because like Danny said, it was haunted object before that. But the hand came about, like the hand is a physical representation of the themes about connection. And it's reaching out. That's Mia's reaching for any kind of connection. She's rejecting the genuine connection with her father, and she's looking for external sources for that validation, that intimacy. You know, when her mother took her own life, you see like through the Snapchat clips how close they were, like with physical touch and stuff. Mia's been robbed of all of that, so she's just looking for it in any way she can. And you see every ounce of intimacy slowly get stripped away from her throughout the film. And she's clinging more and more to the false connections. So the hand was a physical representation.
You know, it's desperate. It's reaching.
Yeah, and it's all about touch and connection and things like that.
That's, well, it's great that you actually have to hold this hand to ignite what's going to take place.
Exactly. Yeah. So, in the original short film, I remember it now, it was like just a haunted object and it was chanting. So like the actual, like that, the talk to me and that, it just came in the drafts. And yeah, it was all about like her, like reaching out to something, talk to me, like conversing with someone, like something she's not doing with her father.
Yeah,
and I let you in. She's not letting anyone in emotionally. So it was all got to do with like her psyche and her mental state.
Well, if she just would talk to her father, if you know,
everything
talk to
would
her,
have been
if everything would be okay. It's like they're dancing around the, you know, facing what's happened and admitting what has happened. You know, that's the issue. She's not there with her dad. They're not connecting. And that's what needs to happen.
Yeah. Well, it's a beautifully acted and beautifully written character. And she does an amazing job. But for those who have not seen the movie, tell our audience the plot of Talk to Me.
Well, I can tell you, like, the elevator pitch is kids that use demonic possession to get high.
That's a pretty good pitch.
Yeah. And we follow a character that relies more and more on the supernatural to fulfill what's empty in her life. I think it's like roughly how to describe the film.
Teenagers using demonic possession to get high.
It's probably better. Just leave it at that one.
Leave it at that, yeah. Well, what was the reaction the first time you saw it with an audience?
It was at the Adelaide Film Festival. You know, we did one little screening before that with just some people to see if things were landing. But the first like audience of like the finished film was Adelaide Film Festival. No one knew what the film was about or anything. So
Talk to Me doesn't tell you much.
It doesn't. So people like that.
There was no poster. There was nothing.
Yeah. And then there was a lot of people like our fans and stuff that came. It's like, what they're expecting is probably not what they're going to get. And we didn't know the reaction.
It's not Raka Raka.
Exactly. Not at all. It's they were probably expecting some crazy, you know, comedy horror splatter film or something, you know.
Right.
And it wasn't that. So it was good. The reception was good. I didn't believe that people liked it when they said they did. You know, when they go, you go, oh, it was great. It's like, yeah, okay, what do you really think?
Yeah.
That was the entire night. He's like, okay, but what do you actually think? Like the whole night. He was like, what was shit about it?
Yeah, they said, what was good about it? I said, oh, what was shit about it?
Yeah. I want to see what. Michael was so sure everyone was lying to him.
Yeah, they were just like being supportive and stuff.
It felt like the reaction was really amazing. And then we started to get confidence with the film. Like we took a promo reel out to Cannes Film Market. And like off of that, just about sold the entire world internationally for theatrical distribution off the promo reel.
So is that where you got A24 involved?
No.
Did that come after the fact, or were they involved from an investment point?
Yeah. So we made the film. We took it to Cannes Film Market. There was like selling so well. There was like a small bidding war between some companies to sell the US distribution. And our producer's like, I think we've got a good film here. What if we take that and try and get into one of these bigger festivals? So we'd applied for South by Southwest, Sundance, and Berlin Film Festival and a bunch of festivals. And yeah, we got into Sundance and we got into South by Southwest and Berlin. And then, so we hadn't sold the US distribution rights yet. And then after the premiere of the film at Sundance, the offers started coming in. And it was like...
Right, so Sundance was where it happened, where Sundance, the cash registers started to ring.
Yeah, and then you start hearing, like, oh, there's a bidding war thing going. You're like, whoa. And then A24 asks to meet us, you know, and we're sitting in our hotel with no sleep. And then A24 come in and they're pitching themselves to us. And we're like, is this real right now?
We're used to doing the pitching, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It was like, so weird.
Like our producer, she said that she's tried forever to get a meeting with A24. It never happened, you know? And now they're saying to us, oh, this is why we think we're right to distribute your film.
And they're like describing who they were. We're like, we know who you are.
Yeah, we'd always make jokes that we're making an A24 film on set and in the edit. That was a thing. That was a running joke. Yeah. It's not very A24 of you to be lingering on that shot. Yeah. Things like that. We never thought that would become a reality.
It seems impossible. And I think there was going to be another offer that came in that was going to be bigger and stuff, but it was like that studio and like those people. And they were so personable. Like when they came in, introduced themselves to us. Then they left the state. They went back to New York. And then they flew back again with more people. And then
they heard there was another offer.
Yeah.
And they know their shit in the genre.
Yeah.
They know their shit in the genre. They were awesome people. And
And then also like we had like lunch with Ari Aster the day, a few days after. And he was saying how much he trusts them and how they never, you know, depend on his vision for things. You know, like they were great. They're amazing to work with. So kind of having that confidence of people that have worked with them in the past before, and also we're just the biggest fans of them. It was like they felt the right one.
Well, it was interesting what they did with Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. Feels very akin to Talk to Me in some ways.
Yeah, definitely. So many of their films, it was just, man, what a dream.
So the Sundance screening, that had to be one of the highs of your life.
Yeah.
So was it a midnight show?
Yeah. Well, actually, the screening itself was the worst feeling in the world, because it was the first time that critics were going to see it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It was the first time that you know, the industry was going to see it, and there was going to be reviews and things like that. They were talking about all these people that are going to be there, and I was
critics,
like,
agents,
I'm like, is there finances, any like I don't know, like audience members going to be there, like, you know? And then so in the screening I was dying.
So the dread of
whole movie. And it was like
someone would get up to go to the toilet and you go, they hate it. And they go past, they walk past you, they open a door.
All this light
would light, you know, come and wash over the whole cinema.
Our lives are over.
Yeah, they're taking it out of the thing. And then the door would close. And then the person would come back in,
The light comes back in again. And then it was like.
And then they shuffle to get to their seats. You're like, oh my God.
Yeah, but like this movie, like the whole time I can remember feeling really embarrassed that Ari had been invited, because Ari Aster was there. And I like got up to walk over to him to apologize to him. I got up and I was going to say, I'm so sorry that you got dragged here, because I know the agents, I think, invited him and stuff like that. And so like I went up to apologize to him, and then he's like, that was really special. And I was like, really? And then we started getting the feedback and stuff. But like, in our heads the whole time we were fucking.
Yeah, we had no, because it's, you know, it was all, our whole lives been building up to doing a film. Yeah. You know, and then getting into Sundance, and there was the hype around it going in. There was a buzz about the film. No one had seen it. Like, people, let's just relax a little bit here. Yeah. Because we don't know. You guys don't
lower
know.
Expectations,
yeah,
like, please.
I want to not know. You know, that's what I want.
Because I think the agents had seen it, and then they gave word to people. Then people started coming in, and it was just like, everyone was coming in with like a higher expectation.
Yeah, you don't want
like, to... We already were like intimidated by the fact we were at Sundance. Because I'm like, fuck, like, I'm like, everyone's going to think we're so shit at Sundance. And then, yeah, and then there was an expectation on top of that. I was like, it will die.
Yeah, and I was like, this, yeah, it was like really built up, this big shadow of this film, you know. It's, you know, crazy. And then like, I in my mind, I'm like, I would have rather no one know anything and then just go in, you know.
Yeah.
But it worked out, so.
Well, you can't hide an audience's reaction to a genre film. That's one of the great things about comedy and one of the great things about horror. You can feel how it's going down, and you had to have felt the excitement of this audience.
Yeah, as soon as the opening scene happened and that whole room reacted, it was like... It still, for some reason, didn't settle us down. I was still a bit like...
Yeah, we were still disconnected from it and looking... We're just waiting for something to go wrong. So we're looking for when the audience comes up, it's like, that. Everyone's laughing, but well, look.
But Ari said he had the same experience where there was like a speaker at the back of the cinema that was like flicking on and off or something.
It was broken.
Like,
one of them was busted.
Broken.
So,
and like,
so one of the channels was out.
Yeah, and then he was sitting right at that speaker. So that if I was... Oh, man. That would have been even worse.
Oh, what was it? At the South by Southwest screening for
it was out of
it,
sync.
They played it out of sync.
Oh, no.
The film. And, like,
and they didn't stop and start it?
They did we eventually did. Because
halfway through.
I was so like... you know, involved with the audio process to an annoying amount when we were mixing the film and everything. Because I'm so specific that when we were doing the screenings, I'm like, I don't want to be like that now. The movie's done. So when it was out of sync, I'm like, that's 3 frames out of sync. You know, but I didn't want to say anything. But then producer Sam, she's like, it's out of sync. I'm like, oh, thank God. And then we went out and then we spoke.
There's like a PTSD from it. Every time a screening starts, I'm like, is it going to be in sync?
Yeah, you have to worry. How's it going to sound? That's a big thing. Are they playing it loud enough? What's the sound like, you know? But yeah, we stopped and started it at a right time, and no one seemed to have noticed, but we certainly did.
Yeah, of course you did. Now, it's played at festivals around the world, so have you seen different reactions in different countries?
Yeah, every screening has been different, the reactions. There was one screening in, I think it was Berlin, that was completely silent.
Wow.
And we're like, goodness. And then, like, it was like the horror moments, it was like it kind of like a few like that, and then you go up and then at the end everyone clapped and everyone stayed for the Q&A, and we're like, we said it, we're like, we don't know what you guys saw, it was really quiet in here, you know. And they're like, we were just so engrossed in the movie, and then everyone started cheering, you know.
Yeah.
So like, we're like, oh, awesome.
But to be fair, we weren't there for the entire movie, we just came at the end, and we're like, it's very quiet in here. But like,
like every like the South by Southwest, that's the rowdiest crowd. You know,
yes.
You know, that was a rowdy crowd. There's some screens you go to where that people are like yelling at the screen, "Don't! No, no, not the hell!" You know, that sort of stuff. And like, that's cool. They're like verbally and gross. Sorry, that peak.
This is so exciting, and I'm so excited to help spread the word about this movie and to have you guys here. And in person, we've had to do so many Zoom shows, and we're back to doing it in person. So glad you could come here. What is next for you guys?
We've finished a script for a horror film called Bring Her Back, and I'd love to shoot that ASAP, if possible. But we'll see. That's what, like, right now is our full finished product that we've got. I'm like, oh, please, let's just shoot that ASAP. So we'll see.
It's kind of like, you know, you get told the second film is in ways more important than the first. You know, first is prove that you can come here, and the second one's prove that you should stay.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of like... finding the one that's right. And we have so many ideas, but we have those finished.
It's done. I really badly want to make it.
Yeah.
And did you guys move to LA?
No.
You're still
Australian. We're still based Australia, but, you know.
We're so, like.
We're usually.
You're mobile.
We're usually in Australia like 2 months of the whole year.
We're like so all over the place.
This year, we've been here for Australia for 2 weeks. You know?
Well, yeah, I've been there a little longer, but yeah. It's like, not really there that much, but yeah, we will be.
Well, guys. Good luck with the film. It's so great to meet you and share your enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And just hoping for much more from the Filippo brothers.
Let's do this again sometime.
I'm all for it. Next time.
Yeah. Cheers, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.